It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, it's hard to imagine getting any more farm to table than my next guest because he's a farmer that is connecting everything. He's connecting growing the livestock and processing the livestock and actually marketing it through their own restaurants. It's the sort of thing that many people are aspiring to. James Rickert, I really want to welcome you to Farm to Table Talk and congratulate you on kind of living the dream of a lot of people. How'd you manage that?
Thank you very much, Roger. Thank you for having me today.
James, you're identified as the director of farm, so I assume you're the farmer, sort of.
I'm the farmer.
With Belcampo Farms. What is Belcampo Farm?
Well, Belcampo is a vertically integrated meat company based in far northern California at the base of Mount Shasta. So we do everything from raising the animals, and we operate our own USDA-inspected processing facility where all the animals are processed. And then we supply a restaurant chain that's primarily located in the San Francisco Bay Areas and Los Angeles areas, but we just opened one location in March of 2019 in New York City.
Wow, that's something. Now, did you start off as a farm or start off as a restaurant?
Kind of a little bit of both. So Belcampo was an evolving company starting in the early 2000s, but it really, in 2012 is when it was, when the actual Belcampo name was placed on what was going on up by Mount Shasta. But what happened was the main owner of the company really wanted a vertically integrated, diversified farm that produces some of the best meats in the world. And started off in this ambitious journey and slowly added a USDA-inspected facility and added restaurants as well to be able to share these amazing meats with the rest of the public. And so it all kind of happened organically.
So how did you get onto it?
Well, I worked for my family's business for 12 years after I graduated school. I went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. I'm a fifth-generation rancher from Northern California. So I grew up on a farm in a small town called Fall River Mills. And boomeranged back up to Northern California after graduation. Worked for my family's business for 12 years, raising cattle. The business is called Prather Ranch, with also a similar program, vertically integrated, has all the production in Northern California, a slaughter facility, and then a restaurant in the Ferry Building in San Francisco. So I worked there for many years, and when there were some changes afoot there, I thought, you know, I'm going to do something else, and went and got my commercial appraiser's license and did farm and ranch appraisals for about 3 years, and kind of just went on my own, did my own thing, and then got a phone call out of the blue from a headhunter who's looking for a farmer to run Belcampo. And I was fairly familiar with Belcampo. I had done some appraisal work for them. Also, them sharing a similar space in the Bay Area specialty meat world. I did go visit their Larkspur location. So I was familiar with them and had my own opinions. But deep down, I thought if anyone's really going to figure out this this crazy thing that we're all trying to do here, Belcampo's the one. And ultimately, I'm really glad I answered the phone and talked to that headhunter, and glad I jumped on board this company. We're doing some great things, and I'm excited.
Well, you described these crazy things we're all trying to do here. What do you call it? I mean, is it a specialty meat business? Is it a farm to fork, farming operation?
Those are all crazy things that farmers do. We all are. When I refer to that is that there's a lot of farmers out there that are great cattlemen and raise a great product, and then they have to send their animals off to a processing facility. Then they get the meat back in a bunch of boxes, and then they torture themselves by waking up at 4:30 in the morning to drive long distances to farmers markets in the Bay Area or wherever.
That's right.
And they are spread so thin. You wear 50 hats when you try to be vertically integrated, and it is so difficult to be able to, you're a jack of all trades, but oftentimes you end up being a master of none. And so that's what I refer to as being crazy, because it's a crazy thing for a farmer to try to think that they can be a retailer as well. We really need to focus on what we do best and what we really love to do, and we need to follow our hearts and realize, hey, this is what I really want to do, and I'm going to do that and do it well.
But then connect vertically, because that's the other thing. Farmers and ranchers have for years, tried to pull themselves together to run a packing plant. And they think, well, if we can just get the livestock slaughtered and then sell it to supermarkets and so forth. But then that has its problems, too.
The processing part is such a big part of it.
So this is the other dimension that you're adding, is that you're going vertical beyond that. So you're raising the livestock, and you've got the processing, and you've got the restaurants.
Correct.
Is there a retail? Can you get retail meat from you as well?
Absolutely. We just started a new initiative. We partnered with Erewhon Market down in far southern California. Mm-hmm. We have what's called kind of a shop and shop. So it's a designated area within the supermarket where you can buy all the Belcampo products. So we have our eggs sold there. We have vacuum sealed steaks, New York steaks, ribeyes, those types of things. We have a variety. Our whole sausage line is there. Our salamis are there. We have whole heritage style birds. The Freedom Rangers. We've got all of our Belcampo products there. So you can go purchase those at a retail level. It's interesting. We have, I was just at a demo there at the Santa Monica location. Well, our butcher shop and restaurant is just a few blocks away there. And we were really worried about if people were going to stop going to Belcampo Butchery, go to the butcher shop and only go to Erewhon. But a lot of people really felt it was such a complementary partnership, because when you're busy on a Saturday and you've got 20 errands to run, number 21 might be going by and getting that really high-end steak from Belcampo. But if you're already going to the grocery store and you're going to Erewhon, you can just grab it there. And so, if anything, it just raises awareness of our product. And so those types of branded partnerships are really good for us. It gets our name out, gets our product out, and keeps us in front of consumers.
Well, let's start at the ground level, literally at the ground level, and describe the ranch land, because most of these products are pasture based or pasture raised.
Correct.
So if we drive up there, what does that look like to us? If we want to come and see your ranch, what do we see?
Well, Belcampo, we own and operate 27,000 acres of ranch land and farmland in far northern California. And we've got one large winter range property in Tehama County outside of the town of Cottonwood, but the rest of the main farms are located in the Shasta Valley. So we're just a little bit north of the town of Mount Shasta, near the town of Weed and the town of Montague, Grenada, all are local communities to us. But specifically, I'll talk about the farm, which is located near the small town of Gazelle. We have the main farm. We grow a variety of crops there. We utilize a lot of center pivot irrigation systems, and so we are irrigated there. We grow a lot of grain that we will raise for our hog or our poultry programs, but we grow a lot of alfalfa, a lot of irrigated pastures for grazing purposes, and then a lot of just mixed species pastures. So you have a lot of perennial grasses and perennial clovers that we'll do a high-intensity, short-duration grazing program on.
Now, let's take it species by species now. So starting with the cattle, explain the kind of or the breeds maybe and the season for raising the beef.
Sure. So we have two different herds with the program. We have a fall calving herd and a spring calving herd. Our herd is composed primarily of Hereford and Angus. We do have some remnant Charolais and some remnant Wagyu in our bloodlines, but it's primarily Hereford and Angus.
So the calves are black baldies that we used to refer to.
You got it. Exactly. Yeah, we've got
black with white faces.
You got it. That's really our program. Primarily, and it's a really high quality animal that performs extremely well in our climate and has top notch meat. So when we look at our breeding program, we're very focused on growth traits. It's important to us that our animals actually perform, but we're really focused on the carcass traits. So marbling, ribeye size, those types of things. We really want to know that we've got high quality animals coming through the pipeline, because we are a company that sells to a consumer, and we're not just a farm that sells an animal off to the yard and it disappears and it goes on a cattle truck and they never see it again. We've got someone in our company that is standing behind a butcher case selling a piece of meat to a customer. We've got a server coming up to a customer saying, "How was your steak tonight?" Those are, so we need to be able to have a good high quality product. So that's why we choose those breeds.
Well, let's talk about the pigs.
Absolutely.
What are the pigs?
So we have, we all heritage crosses, but it's basically three different breeds. We've got Berkshires, I should say, Chester Whites, and Duroc's.
Do they cross, or are they, absolutely, are you keeping separate?
Yeah,
so they crossbreed those.
We crossbreed those for good genetic diversity with our program, but those are kind of the three cornerstones of our breeding program with the swine department.
Duroc's are red, and the Chester Whites are white, obviously, and what people don't know is the Berkshire's got that little funny turned-up nose.
Yeah.
And when you cross them all up, do they get rid of the nose, or do they still have turned-up noses?
You know, it's just varying levels of all the above. But yeah, we've got a really some unique colors, and we also have some red wattles that have been, you know, we've got, you know, a sow that might have some red wattle in her, and so we've got some, sometimes we'll look in the farrowing house, we'll go, wow. That's some really unique pigs there. I mean, we had a few that just had this like gray hair color that there's just two out of our litter. It was like, or out of a group of piglets, and went, wow, those are some neat colors.
So you breed these sows, and then you have the other pigs 3 months, 3 weeks, and 3 days
you
later. They have the pigs, and then they're probably market size in 6 months to 9 months.
Our processing time is usually right around 9 months.
And because. Now, your ration wouldn't be, is it just corn straight on and some protein, or what do you feed them?
No, it's a combination. We grow a lot of barley that we'll grind down, and then we'll mix with other, like a concentrate that we'll get from a feed company. Mm-hmm. So it's a variety of things, but we are kind of relying more and more on just getting a high quality finished feed from what I call just getting it from town, mm-hmm. As opposed to grinding it ourselves. It's a great way for us to cut costs and growing and being very vertical and raising the grain and then grinding it and then feeding it on farm. But it also comes with a cost as well.
So when they have the pigs, are they in pens or crates when they farrow?
We have what we call farrowing pens. And so they're about, 10 by 12? And then we have an escape area. So one thing that you've, a lot of things you need to focus on in the farrowing house is that mama is very prone to rolling over on her piglets.
Squishes
them. Just squishes them. And she doesn't mean to. She just weighs, you know, 400, 500 pounds. And,
right.
And she's just so big. And, you know, obviously pregnancy and birth is something that I really probably should not talk about because I've never gone through it myself. But, you know, it's not an easy time for them. And it's stressful. So when the piglets are born, we do have these pens set up to where there's a couple escape areas and with a big bar to where the sow can't come over. And even if she leans and falls over on it, that those piglets are able to kind of be in this refuge area. And then we're up in Siskiyou County. So we have heat lamps for the piglets to keep them nice and warm and comfortable
warm.
And some good bedding for them. And so they can kind of do their little pig pile in the corner and fall asleep. And then they run over to mom and nurse. And we keep them in the farrowing house for really kind of depends on, you know, when they're ready and then conditions, but, you know, 1 to 2 weeks tops. Mm-hmm. And then we do put them out in what's called a group lactation pen. And so we'll get 8 to 10 sows and all their babies in the group lact pen. Mm-hmm. And they're all together. And it's really, you know, you've kind of gotten out of the maternity ward and now you're into that kindergarten preschool. So that's when the piglets make
they're
friends.
All mixed with all of them together then.
Yeah. So oh, yeah. And then even the sows, you'll see one pig runs up to one mom and nurses and runs to another mom and nurses.
Oh, no, that's different.
And the moms really, it's a little different right after birth.
Sure.
They're very protective. But then once they're out and they're like, thank goodness, I'm out in the field. I'm out of the, you know, I'm outdoors again and I can stretch my legs. This is good. So they're happy. And the piglets, they just run amok and they it's really fun watching their personalities develop at that age. And then we wean, and then we create independent kind of a market group. And then we say that market group, X amount of pigs that we wean that month is that month's market group.
Now, are they on pasture? Are they in dry lot? Or?
They're on pasture. And
okay.
So for our group lactation, we try to keep them in as best of conditions as possible. So we try to have it in, you know, good high-quality green grass. We really don't want to have dusty, dry conditions, especially at that time when the piglets are so small, you'll get a lot of respiratory issues. So it's important to keep them in the best fields we can at that point. And then from there, you know, market groups, they're becoming a little more hardy. They can handle different, different pasture types. But one thing that we like to do is we'll have a grain field, we'll harvest the grain, and then we'll harvest the straw for bedding for the pigs because that's
right, sure.
Vertically integrated. That's what you do. I'd rather grow it and bale it myself than buy it. And then from there, we'll turn the pigs out in the field. And then the pigs have a great time running around the field looking for some of the grain that got dropped out of the combine there when we were cutting. And then they'll be on that field. And then also they really help break that field down. A lot of the debris, mm-hmm. A lot of the crop debris is broken down. And the pigs, we basically just have to sacrifice that field to the pigs. We let them have fun, and we'll have a wheel line or two on and rotate that around to keep it nice and moist and keep the dust down as much as we can. And then from there, we'll take those pigs off and rotate them to a different field. But we just use the pigs as part of our kind of our grain crop rotation. So add a lot of fertilizer and help break down that field for us.
Now, what about the chickens?
Yeah, chickens. So we basically get 24-hour old chicks in the mail. We don't actually
literally hatch in the mail. They come in big boxes.
We get them in a box, and we have to go to the post office. And we work with two different hatcheries on the birds that we get. But one is from up in Oregon, and so they'll send it, and we go pick it up at 7 a.m. And take it immediately to our brooder house, open up the box, and hope that everyone landed in good condition. And then from there, we'll place them in our brooders. We keep the birds in the brooders for about 4 weeks up until the point they can thermoregulate. And then after they're ready for the outdoors, we take them to the outdoors. So we'll put them out in the fields in different locations. And then from there, they're raised outdoors up until, well, in the case of our layer program, we keep them outdoors and then they just lay eggs for us. But in the case of our broiler program, our Cornish Crosses or our Freedom Rangers, we'll keep them in outdoor paddocks up until the point they're taken to the processing facility.
Is it different breeds you use for laying than for the broilers?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So which are the?
Yeah, so we, our layers, Barred Rocks are a great breed for us. So we've got Barred Rocks, we've got Sex Links, and we've got Novigens. And those are our primary layers. And then for the broilers, we have a Cornish Cross and then also a Freedom Ranger. And the Cornish Cross is a little more lazy. They like to sit in the shade near the water and the food. Whereas the Freedom Rangers, they're the ones that I really enjoy raising. They love to get out and run around. And
is that a new breed, Freedom Ranger?
No, it's not a new breed. I don't know all of the origins behind it to be totally accurate. But it's a great breed for us. They work really well in our climate, and they perform well.
They red or white?
And they're red, and they taste great. And it's the best flavored chicken that we produce, in my opinion.
And the layers, what breed is the layers?
As I was saying, the Barred Rocks, the Novigens, and the Sex Links. And yeah, we get a lot of we have a small amount of other breeds as well. So we've got some, Americanas that lay some other neat colored eggs.
Speaking of the eggs, what are the color of the eggs?
Dark brown.
Dark brown?
Dark brown. Yeah, we have kind of different shades of brown, but, eggs.
What's the color of the yolks?
Oh, dark yellow. I mean, when you have eggs out on, these chickens out on pasture like this, and the insects they're eating and the nutrients they're getting out in the field, it really comes through in the yolks.
Love those orange yolks.
Oh, yeah. You can just see these dark yolks, and that's what brings people back. All of our meats have such a unique flavor. And when we sell to some people, some people that are older in life, they're like, hey, that reminds me of my childhood. I used to get those off my grandpa's farm. And it just takes me right back to me being 10 years old and going to visit my grandpa's farm. But it's also neat because we're able to give those experiences to other people that may not have had this growing up. And they're like, hey, this is what an egg really needs, should be tasting like. This is what it looks like. This is what it really should look like, not just these really wimpy looking yolks.
So let's go to the lambs.
Yeah.
So describe what you're raising for sheep.
Yeah, we have a Dorper breed that we raise.
What's that?
It's just a particular breed. It's a white faced lamb. We have 1,200 ewes, and we lamb in the spring, and we just went through our lambing season. And we've got a really high quality product. One thing that's neat is that the cattle and the lamb programs are very compatible. In our rotational grazing program, we'll turn the cattle out in the field and let them graze. And cattle they're just a bunch of divas. They're very picky. They won't eat things they don't like, and we'll get them off the field. Then we'll bring the sheep in. And sheep are a little more content with lower quality forage than cattle, and so they can kind of do cleanup. And then so we'll bring the sheep into that spot, and then we'll pull the sheep out. And then that field has been fully grazed, and we'll get the water back on it, and get it growing again. But the sheep, it's a program that's been really successful at Belcampo. We actually, we really turn heads with our lamb. We don't have a very strong flavor to our lamb, and that's probably our biggest comment that we get back from consumers. A lot of people don't like lamb because it's so strong and it's so powerful. We have a very mild product, and there's probably 100 reasons why our product is that way, whether it be from the way they're handled and processed. You know, it's very humane, so very minimal cortisol levels, those types of things. The fact that they're, you know, on good high quality pastures their entire lives, that has a lot to do with it. Breed, you know, time of when we harvest. I mean, there's a lot of factors, but we really perform well with our lamb program, and enough to where last year we won the best non-beef burger in LA with our lamb burger.
Oh, I want to try it sometime. So the with the lamb is seasonal, mm-hmm. and you, it's really easy. You get eggs every single day, mm-hmm. and your cattle, you can kind of spread them out, but with lambs, you got a good season for them, and you recently lambed, and they're going to be kind of optimum size at a certain stage. So to be able to market them through, are you chilling or freezing some of the product? Because,
correct.
Because if you tried to do it every single day, it's pretty hard to keep the quality.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. We actually, we've shifted to more of like a batch processing with our lambs, is that we process them all over a two-month period, and then from there, and then immediately take that and put that in the freezer. It's just what we need to do to be able to supply our product over the year.
You know, I was talking to Alice Waters at Chez Panisse one time, and I was trying to convince her that she needed to go to frozen lamb. I don't think I got her sold on it yet, but I was making the very same point that if you've got a restaurant like that, when you have a hard time having the fresh supply, have it in perfect condition 52 weeks a year because it is so seasonal. And I think she was almost convinced. But you have your own restaurant, so it's
correct.
So your chefs can say, this works well for us.
Yeah, and that's the beautiful thing about having our restaurants. We have the ability to make changes at the retail level. So, you know, one thing that I was taught at a very early age from my father is that you need to fully utilize an animal. And so his model was, I'm going to sell because he was really the farm and the slaughter facility, but was involved in the retail side, but wasn't the person making those decisions, but said, hey, I'm going to sell the retail division a whole animal. Everything goes as one unit, and that one unit is one whole animal. And then from there, it's on you. You need to sell everything. And so that's really a model that's unique. And then having our own restaurants is that we can really sell. We can all of a sudden run a different special. We can, if we're kind of getting long on something, we can flip a switch and start marketing that. Or in the butcher case, we can have some flexibility and sell different products. And so try to keep that balance in check, because a lot of people that want to go into the specialty beef business, they go into it going, man, I got these great steaks and I'm going to just sell steaks and this is great. And then they turn around and look in their freezer and it's just filled to the brim with ground beef. And so it's just all about balance. You've really got to make sure that you really balance your sales strategy. Otherwise, you're going to be caught with a freezer full of ground beef.
Well, if you've got some cuts on the other hand, that freezer full of ground lamb, when it's the best burger in Los Angeles or the demand you get in restaurants, you can afford to take shoulder and some other things and grind it up.
Correct.
And use it into the ground lamb, and mm-hmm. you're getting a premium for it anyway.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Now, that gets to the other issue that a lot of people struggle with, because there are people that raise each of these animals that you've talked about, and that I've talked to many that are going to a certain restaurant with certain products or going to the farmer's market, like you were mentioning earlier, and working their tail off trying to take care of that market. But where everybody else hits a wall, that you've built a wall, is having a processing plant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is huge.
I
would imagine there's a lot of farmers listening to this conversation right now saying, boy, I wish I could do that.
Yeah.
How do you do that? I mean, you've got four different species of animals. Are you able to process them all in the same plant?
Absolutely. And that's one of the biggest challenges we have, is that we are a multi-species facility. So we've got, one day is birds, the next day is cattle, the day after that are pigs. And so we have so many moving parts there, and we really need to train our employees on the kill floor that, hey, guess what we're doing today, guys? We're doing birds, and we've got 1,400 birds that we need to process in 8 hours. Ready? Go. And then the next day's beef, and you've got to shift into beef processing, and then you've got to shift into pigs, and then we've got lambs, and so all these different things. So it's a big challenge. We are very, very blessed that we have this facility, but it's also it's a challenging part of our company. It's hard to staff
a butchery. Think so, because they have to be trained to do so many things. In some of the really large packing plants that have a line going, and they have cattle or hogs going down that line, somebody might be in one spot and they do just the same cut every day.
Now, exactly.
It'd be easy to train for that in a way because it never varies, but it'd be a terrible job, I think. It'd be, I could see one advantage to people that are working in your plant. They probably don't mind the variety that they actually are doing some different things every day.
Exactly. I think that you would go crazy just working in one of those bigger plants with all you do is you stand in one place, you're on the disassembly line, and all you do is just take this knife and make one cut. Next animal.
Yeah.
And the same, and you do it for 8 hours.
Yeah.
That is why you have such high turnover.
So you got butchers, basically. I mean, when they're able to do all these different species, rather than just a line worker in a packing plant, you've got people that you've trained them to be accomplished butchers.
It's a craft.
Yeah.
It really is a craft. And there's not enough words in the language to give a compliments to the guy that runs the plant. We've got two people that really run the plant, Angie and David. But I will give David a lot of credit for he's the one teaching people how to break these animals down and really brings the art to that. And he's a lot of fun to watch. But he's my counterpart at the butchery. Gets people trained well and inspires them and helps them see that big picture. And as I was saying, it's so hard to staff because we're in rural Siskiyou County. You know, there might be 1,000 people that need a job. There might be 50 that are actively looking for a job. And there might be one that might pass the drug test to get you into Belcampo Butchery. Hmm. So it's challenging. And then once you get the job, you're in a spot where animals come to die and then you help break them apart into meat. And then get those packaged and send them out down the road. That's not a pretty process any way you look at it. But it is so critical in our business. It needs to be done right. And you really need people that treat animals with respect. You need people that really see the big picture of our company and what we're accomplishing. And that's a challenge. So one of the ways I've really looked at trying to give some of these employees the big picture is get those people that are working at the plant. If there's one day we're not processing something, let's get them out to the farm and let's get them to where they see the animals. And all of a sudden they get to see the big picture a little bit more and get them more excited about what we're doing. And by that, I'm hoping that next time they see beef, they have a different respect for these animals.
So are you able to give them 40 hours a week?
Absolutely.
Because that's a big thing, too, because some of the people that have meat lockers, you know, they're trying to bring somebody in just when they need them or bring some extra people in, then the labor's not there. So you got to balance it. You're promising these people a 40-hour job. Are they able to get insurance or any other benefits?
Yep. Yeah. No, we've got a full line of benefits if you're a full-time employee. It is a good gig. It's just a gig where I think it's also in Siskiyou County where there's a lot of people that work on ranches and you're in the outdoors and you're changing irrigation water and you're doing these things and you've got this big mountain staring back at you. And so there's a lot of, employment out there, but selfishly, that's what I do, but as the farmer, but it's a better job than being out in the field and working with the cattle than it is sitting there working on the kill floor.
Sure.
It's hard to sugarcoat that, but you've got to find people that really love that camaraderie and really love what they do. And we've got some people that take pride in what they do and they're amazing. And I just can't say enough good things about them.
Yeah. Well, you know, they ought to be able to stick a card in the package of meat and saying, you know, this lamb chop was prepared by John or Mary or whoever.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and they need
they
to take pride in
it and package it and so forth.
Exactly. And we also have butchers at all of our restaurants they're the people that are we'll send primals down and they'll be breaking them down and stuff. But they really get that too. And I'd love to see more butchers come up to the plant and people from the plant go down and at the butcher shops and get that.
So it's a primals when you say primals.
Yeah, just a large chunk of meat that gets broken down.
It's not the whole carcass. It's like the hind quarter or the front
Yeah, or the, a middle, you know, some of the middles that, that will be individually cut into steaks at the restaurant level.
Tell me at the restaurant level, mm-hmm. If somebody goes to the restaurant, how much of your story is available to people that are eating at the restaurant?
Well, that's a great question. We try to get as much of our story to them as possible. So you've got to think, when you walk into a restaurant, what do you have? We've got a lot of signs all around that tell people about the story. We try to maintain a large presence on social media with Instagram and Facebook as far as pictures of what we do and how we do it to really get people engaged. So we've got the electronic component. We've got the signage component. But then all of a sudden, you've got a server that comes up and welcomes you to your table. We need that server to know what's going on at the farm. And so they can say, hey, this is Belcamp. Welcome to Belcampo, and explain a little bit of our story. They only have 10 to 20 seconds to get that story across, but they also need to have a full arsenal of answers in their back pocket whenever somebody asks them a question. Sure. So part of my job is not only being the farmer, but our CEO, Anya, was like, James, you've got to go down to the restaurants and tell all of our compadres there what you're doing and what's going on at the farm. And there's times where I'll type up, I try to do this quarterly, but kind of a farm report that I email to our kind of head of the meat company, and here you go, share it with your team and let everyone know what's going on at the farm. And so they'll have this farm report, and they'll say, yeah, you know, we're just got done with lambing season. We're in the middle of first cutting a hay harvest at the farm, and we're doing this, and this is what's going on. And so it just connects people to that big picture, which is one of my biggest missions in this company, is really get that big picture mentality to every single employee, that they know they're part of this bigger team. And this bigger vision, this bigger revolution in the meat industry, and get excited about it.
So I wonder if you can have a contest like the top waiter in your new New York restaurant gets to win a trip out to the ranch or something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, and then also part of, at the ranch, we have a thing that's called Meat Camp. And what is Meat Camp? Because I always get that. I'll bring it up and people are like, what the heck are you talking about? So it's really a 3-day culinary experience where we'll have people come from all across the nation, even different points in the world, come all the way out to rural Siskiyou County to go stay in a safari-style tent out in the middle of a farm with thousands of animals around them. And we will teach them everything from knife sharpening skills to building a fire on. We have a large asado grill on the farm, so we love
what
to
is
just.
That?
It's a kind of an Uruguayan style, Argentinian style. It's a big cart where we have a big area in the middle where you burn the wood, and then you've got grills on the side where you kind of push once the coals drop down, then you push them to the side. It's great. It's just a lot of fun. Then we have a bunch of small individualized wood-fired grills as well for the meat camp guests. But we basically teach them all about agriculture, Belcampo, all the things that we do, and then a lot of culinary demonstrations. And then also, it's a vacation. So we have a really nice wine and charcuterie pairing. We just give them the best of the best meals. But where I'm going with this is that part of that program is that we get the executive chef from Santa Monica up, or we get our butcher from Oakland up, and we get some of our really like high-end, great people from all of our locations to come up, and they get excited because they come to the farm and they really connect and get their, you know, get some dirt on their boots, kind of, so to speak. But also they're able to connect with people from their community. So for example, last year we had a group from Santa Monica come up that were guests, and we had our executive chef come up from Santa Monica as well. And they kind of looked at each other and said, hey, I know you. They're like, oh, you're familiar. And then they're like, oh, the butcher from Santa Monica is here too. And so it was a big love fest, and they got along great, had a great weekend together. And then now they're like, great, well, we'll see you next week when we come in and we get those ribeyes. And so it's great that they made such a deep connection there at the farm, and that they're able to share that every weekend when they come in and pick up some meat.
It's probably more than I need to know, but if you're using these tents and these nice tents with regular beds and everything, mm-hmm. and maid service that changes the sheets with and it's like a shower a short walk away or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, we've got a couple showers. We've got like three little bathrooms with a shower and toilet and sink kind of thing. So I mean it's very well done. It's very comfortable. But the tent has two queens in it. you know, queen size beds.
Some of your stuff is identified as organic, but not all. Mm-hmm. What's been your experience in utilizing organic, and why do you have it in some cases, but not in all cases?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one thing that I've done is, well, I'll take a few steps back. When you look at sustainability in agriculture, where does it begin? It begins on your balance sheet. You can create the best, highest quality product in the world, but if the cost of production is through the roof, mm-hmm. you have no consumers that can afford it. Mm-hmm. And I also personally, philosophically, don't feel right in producing a product that only 1% of the population can afford. Sure. I want to try to create a product that is as affordable as possible, but yet still has the highest quality standards. Sustainability starts on your balance sheet. You can't be green if you're red. It just is what it is. So one thing that I had seen when I first came on board at Belcampo is that, you know, we had some opportunities with our swine program. We were raising a certified organic pork product. Every animal that I raised on the farm, I was losing money on. I couldn't charge enough for it because we were spending so much money on organic feeds and all these different things that you just look at the cost of production and you go, wow. That is, we would really need to double prices to consumers, and we all know how well that's going to go over. And so, and then you're really limited to when you buy organic feed from town of what that particular formulation is and who they're getting it from. So you're really, and we're limited with where we can get outside feed. So looking at all those factors, I thought, wow, we've really got to, you know, get this program under control. And so we went to just a non-GMO program there. It opens up our options with feed significantly. We lose the certification on the animal, which I'm okay with. We're actually in the middle of that transition right now. So we're still sending organic pigs to the market, but I have pigs down the line that are already transitioned over as, you know, piglets that came in on non-organic feed. So we still have about 3 to 4 months of organic products in the pipeline before that we're going to switch to this this non-GMO program as well.
You know, some people, I think, abuse the promotion of non-GMO because mm-hmm. there's, you know, like 350 commodities we grow in California. There's only like 8 that have GMO in them. Mm-hmm. And so almost all of them don't have any GMO. But in the case of feed, that you're dealing with a trickier situation, aren't you? So what that means in this case is that the corn, for example, couldn't have been Roundup ready.
Correct.
And that they're able to spray Roundup on it because it was genetically engineered to be able to, you know, not be affected by Roundup. So you have to be able to take what most of the corn is, and that's a big part of the ration.
Correct.
But it is confusing.
I feel sorry for consumers. If I wasn't in this industry and I was just an eater myself, I'd be confused. There's a lot to learn. But yeah, it's you know, one thing that also, we may not have certification on that animal, but they're still raised in organic pastures. And that's one thing I think is important too, because a lot of people, you know, I interface with a lot of consumers, and sometimes you get just questions where you go, okay, well, you only know what you know. And if you were raised in a city and you don't really mm-hmm. understand agriculture a lot, and you hear certain bits and pieces of information and you latch onto those, you know, glyphosate and Roundup, it scares a lot of people. For some people, I've had a question of like, well, okay, so if it's not going to be organic, are you raising your animals? I mean, do you spray the field and then you graze on it? And it's like, as a farmer, I had to laugh on the inside a little bit and say, I certainly would not take Roundup to a field and then put an animal and try to graze the grass I just killed. It just doesn't make sense. But to some people, they don't know. And you only know what you know. And I was raised around it. And so it's common sense to me that you wouldn't go and kill a field before you graze it. But other people that might not.
Well,
put two and two together.
I think a lot of people that ask you that question also have it in their garage because they're killing the grass and
totally.
The sidewalk.
Yeah, or complaining about the weeds.
You know, the other issue I think that people have questions about are antibiotic use. So mm-hmm. what do you do when animals are sick, and how do you? What's your policy on using antibiotics?
Exactly. Well, so two things. We are a certified organic program, but we're also certified humane. And I would say over those two, my personal and my heart, certified humane trumps organic. So that said, if we're weaning some calves in our program and they're all organic at this point, if some of these animals, you know, weaning's a stressful time and a few of them get pink eye, I am not going to turn to blind eye, pun intended. I'm going to treat them. And sorry, they just lost their organic status. Their ear tags are going to get notched. They're going to be recorded in our system that they're in a non-organic status. Mm-hmm. And so they will get diverted to a different sales channel, may or may not be Belcampo branded through to the system, or they could be sold underneath a different label that's just a grass-finished beef program. But I'm going to treat that animal. We'll try an organic. We'll attempt to treat that animal organically on round one, because obviously I don't want to lose out on, you know, the financial side of the organic game. I want to capture as much value for these animals, but if that doesn't work, I'm going to immediately take care of that animal and treat it. And that what's unfortunate is that one antibiotic use, that happened at a certain stage of its life, months before it's processed, will boot it out of that program, and therefore it might not even make it to a Belcampo restaurant. But that animal stays on organic feed with the rest of its herd, and will be processed humanely with the rest of that group. So it's just that one one shot. It loses its full potential.
What has surprised you and surprised the people on your team as you've got this whole production system, and is there anything that's been unusual or remarkable from your customers that you said, "Ma, I didn't really know there'd be that much interest in this," or "I didn't see that coming"?
You know, one thing that from my side, just being the farmer, I don't get the nutritional side as much as I probably should as far as the nutrition of our meats. A lot of people support our meat because it's healthier for them. You know, their animals, the flavor, it's easy to tell, but it's hard to really look at a nutritional package on that particular meat versus compare it to another more conventionally raised. So a lot of people are very excited about the nutritional benefits as far from the grass finished beef. But also the eggs, the pork and everything like that. I mean, just getting animals out in the outdoors, having them moving around, using the muscles, having the animals be in the sun, those kinds of things. It adds so much to the flavor of our products. And you can really, really tell the difference. It's just all of our products, if you did a side by side, it's mind blowing. You can really taste the difference. And I'll admit, I was a little on the other side of, wasn't a big fan of grass-fed beef. I was raised, you know, with Prather Ranch. They do a barley finishing program, but we would finish every animal and really wait for it to be ready to process. And it's a really high quality, flavorful piece of meat. That's what I was used to. I wasn't, you know, it's not a traditional corn-fed feedlot or anything like that. So I had my own opinions on grass-finished beef, and I've had some that wasn't the best quality when I was younger in life. And, you know, you kind of have your notions, and not a big fan. Then I spent some time at Belcampo and got to taste what grass-fed tastes like when it's done right. And, oh, man, it's just amazing. Now I'm a total convert, and I love it. And I just love the flavor of our meat. The silkiness to it is just the texture, the flavor. It's hard to beat it.
You know, I think there's people listening to this that want to go and try out your restaurants. I think that there are some farmers that are wanting to figure out how they might be able to copy what you're doing. And I would assume you guys are doing a great job, and you'll be competing with others that'll try to do a great job. But I assume there will be opportunities for farmers to learn from some of your lessons and say, maybe we can go direct. Maybe we can do vertical. Mm-hmm. I know that's not going to be your job to promote others to follow in your footsteps. But as you're successful, some will try to follow in your footsteps.
Absolutely. And I think it's great. I love what we do. I think it's fantastic. I know it's really hard as a small producer waking up at 4 a.m. on a Saturday and hustling to the market. I get it. I've done it. I used to, when I went to school at Cal Poly, I'd come up on weekends from time to time and help out when Prather is first getting established up in the Bay Area. And man, that's a lot of work, and you're hustling and you're talking a lot. And at the end of the day, you don't want to talk to another person about meat anymore. And then you go back to your whatever you're doing in life, and it takes it out of you. But my hat's off to you. And ultimately there's so many opportunities in specialty meat. There's so many consumers, there's so many mouths to feed. The demand's there.
Yeah.
And so I welcome anyone to jump into this. I think it's great. And if you have any questions, find my contact information, reach out to me, come visit. I'd love to show you the farm. I'd love to show you what we do. I'm really proud of what we accomplish up there in Siskiyou County, and as I said, our gates are open. And if you want to come visit, feel free to reach out to me. Go online, find the farm office number, and call the front desk, talk to Jody, and she'll get you hooked up for a great farm visit. We'll take good care of you.
So what's the address online?
Oh, it's belcampo.com.
Belcampo, BelCampo.com. And it's James Rickert, the director of farm. I think there's going to be people take you up on this.
I hope so.
It is exciting what you're doing. My hat's off to you. I think that a lot of people have thought about this, but I haven't heard anybody that's done it to the extent that you are. We wish you the best, and thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.